Hello and welcome to recording number 9 of Gary Gygax's Artifact of Evil, an annotated reading. Today is August 4th, 2021. All right, we're going to start with chapter 7. It's page 77. It is the first paragraph, and I'm going to just jump right into it. Gord hadn't thought it possible, but the forest here was worse than the southern portion they had had to traverse, coming from the Drakenskrabs to reach Badwall. Gord had spent a surprising amount of time in such places, considering he was a city-bred thief, and no forest he had ever traveled in, even the great ones of Netherwood and Andry, had been like this. However, thanks to the woodcraft of Geller, Curly and his associates, and Blanc as well, they made fair progress and never became lost in the thickets and tangles of the Sus. Deirdre and Oscar had been in the same region, and with Gord available to clamber unerringly up trees to visually scout their way, the group managed to move westward at the rate of almost 2 leagues each day as the crow flies. They actually traversed nearly twice that distance, considering the twists and turns of their path as they followed trails or watercourses. Journey was further slowed by ravines and marshes that had to be circumvented, predators to be avoided, and the monstrous denizens of the place to constantly guard against. All right, break. So, one of the things I really like about how Gygax describes terrain is, you know, very little. It's cities aren't flat, wildernesses aren't flat. You know, back when they first went into the Sus and they watched the battle between the Gibberlings and the Kobolds, they were on a rise looking down on a ridge, looking down on them. It's not just, you know, an endless flat terrain. So we're looking at the Sus and we get the information that going further north here from the area around Badwall, that it is getting even more tangled with more thickets and, you know, harder to traverse. And you look at the rate of travel here. They're making, with experienced guides and Gord's ability to climb up trees and look ahead, they're still only making, you know, as the crow flies, about 2 leagues, which is about 6 miles a day in that distance. But they are winding back and forth, either following animal trails or water courses. Now, going north-south, I believe, is the Jewel River that goes through the Sus Forest. So I don't know if they're that far over, because that is actually a little way from the eastern edge and closer to the western edge of the Sus Forest. And so he may just be talking about little unnamed streams that are, you know, feeding into the Jewel or feeding off of the Jewel River. And you also have that there are ravines, you know, that they're coming across. So they are, you know, the Sus Forest is close to that mountain or hill chain, mountain chain, I think it is, offhand. I'm not sure which one it is. And we see on this map provided that we've got the Jewel River and is being shown. And also, you know, I think it's too far across to look at that Handmaiden River that they have on this map. I think the Handmaiden must be a second edition or a Living Greyhawk River, because I don't think that is, you know, mentioned in the first edition sources. Yeah, but it does give us some locations here. You know, it shows Badwall, and it does provide the hex. Now, if this is Anna Meyer's map, then yes, the hexes. Is. All right, then the hexes are only.
Yeah, this is the 12-mile version.
Yeah. Okay. Great. So, that would put 12, 24, 36. I guess it works out, but the narrow version on Darlene's map shows about 60 miles, and the narrow version here, we're looking only out about 40 miles. Now, you know, things are very ill-defined, so it's hard to tell. They have, on Anna's map, the thicker area being here south of Bad Wall, but we do see some darkening up there, so there is supposed to be some thickening up there. So, you know, as TJ mentions, that this doesn't look like the Handmade River looks more like it's from the Living Greyhawk campaign material, rather from either first or second or even third edition, you know, AD&D stuff that had come out. The other thing, Igord mentions about how he had been in several forests, and yeah, you know, he had fought the Battle of Woodsford in the Adry and crossed half of the Adry forest with the various woodsmen, his friend Chert and Stalker and other foresters. Then he was up in the Netherwood, and he was running from the... he had robbed a religious leader of a religious goblet, and he was being chased, and I believe that was the Netherwood. And then he also had been through the Celadon. So he's been through a number of very large, thick forests already, but he's saying that none of them compare to the Sus, which is as it should be, because those forests, like the Adry, if it's not dense with population, but there are foresters and sylvan elves throughout the Adry. And the Celadon definitely has the druids that are mentioned by Curly, who he goes to meet with in the Celadon forest. The Netherwood, I don't know how big it is offhand. He does run into a bandit gang that is in there. And the people who are pursuing him do make their way seemingly quickly enough, coming from the north down south into it. We are, it's asked, are we west of Badwell Town or southwest? And I think the context just makes it clear that we're west and maybe north, headed north of Badwell, because... it says that the forest here is worse than the southern portion that they had to traverse coming from the Drakenscrobs to reach Bad Wall. So yes, I would definitely take this as a north, heading north from Bad Wall. They probably went at an angle, you know, instead of going direct. But originally, it sounded like they had left Bad Wall and headed pretty much directly west, you know, as the closest. And that put Bad Wall a little over 20 miles from the edge of the Sus Forest. So we are getting some detail on locations. You know, like on the Darlene map, those hexes are big. They're 30 miles across. And even with that, the various towns and locations aren't necessarily on the hex that they're shown. Like we can look up in the Bone March and see that Johnsport is so far in that it isn't even on the water, but it really should be a port. It really should be over a hex and showing it's on the water. So it's very nice when Gygax gives us a little detailed information where we can come back and say it's 20 miles or it's a little over 20 miles, rather than just saying, well, it's, you know, there's some time was passed and we've got to try to work out how far that distance actually is. All right, so one of the, like they mentioned here, that even though they've traveled about 6 miles as the crow flies, they've done that twice that distance because of having to weave back and forth. And the terrain isn't just thick, there's also obstacles such as ravines and marshes. And I don't think anybody's really noted, because these marshes are probably very local marshes, and I would imagine that they're areas that are fed from the Jewel River, where streams have come off, and it turned just into a marshy area, rather than as a larger river or stream, where they end up just turning into a very small marsh area that isn't really worth throwing on even a map that has a more expanded. We're going to get more detail because it's showing only 12 instead of 30 miles. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 77 in the second paragraph. There was also the back trail to watch, for they knew full well that the fiery repulse at the copse of trees had not deterred pursuit. Every sort of craft in Diomar possible was used to conceal and make dangerous the path the party followed. Pits with sharpened stakes were prepared by a combination of magic and manual labor. Snares, deadfalls, and spring traps were set along their route. The druidical powers of Curly Greenleaf and Geller were yoked with the magic of the wizard Oscar to create novel surprises, such as sticks suddenly turning into venomous snakes when someone passed, trees that would become partially sentient and attack with their great limbs and the like. They hoped thus to throw off or slow any followers, so as to make their own mission a success. If they could locate their goal, it should take no more than a day to finish their work and push on westward out of the Sus and into the clean air of the Elven Kingdom of Selene and beyond. All right, break. So we have here... again, it shows that they're really, they don't care what's going to happen. They're leaving very deadly or dangerous traps in their wake. And whether this is so important to them that they're really not concerned if those traps happen to catch, say, an unwary hunter or forester or anybody. Who may not be the ones who are actually following them. The other thing I kind of find doubtful is the ability to dig pit traps on such a short time, because they're worried about being chased, and I just think some things like snares and like the spells, definitely they're going to be very quick and short time. Some traps, like a spike trap, where you might have, a branch pulled back so it will swing backwards, and send, have spikes put on it. But actually digging these pit traps with sharpened stakes, that's a bit of a laborious process, and I just wonder, since they're in such haste, it seems like that would be kind of counterproductive, where they want to make time. I doubt they're going to take the time that they'd make it up just by making a few pit traps. So, and the terrain doesn't sound like, if you've ever tried digging in woodland, unless they're using some kind of magical spell, it's incredibly difficult digging where there's a lot of roots. Even if it isn't stony or, very solid ground, and it's also, here's a comment, finally a use for those 18 strength fighters. Yeah, they could use Chert there. I would think that would maybe be an opportunity where there was already a depression that they could cover or something, but it strikes me that spike traps would be a kind of unlikely.
It does say they use a combination of magic and manual labor, though, so.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of what spells that they could use to dig, like there is a dig spell. I'm really not sure how much, because they would have to gather the wood, sharpen the wood, implant it, and then cover it. And it just strikes me that that does not sound quick. Even if you had a magic spell to excavate the ground.
And druids probably wouldn't want to cut living wood. They'd probably want to use something that they gathered.
Yeah, and if they're using some kind of spell to excavate in the middle of the wood, what they're going to do is they're just going to shred the root structure, because in a thick woodlet, what you're going to find is that, you know, the roots of the trees are all over the place, you know, that even if they're the thickness of the wood, if there's a pathway on the ground, immediately below the surface is a huge network of interlaced, you know, root systems. And it doesn't sound productive enough. The druids would do it, that's for sure, even at the sacrifice of some plants and trees. But I don't think it sounds like something. I mean, this is minutia, you know, it really is. It's just when, like, say, when they had Gord and Patrick guarding the same spot, it made no sense to me. And then next time they have one person watching the way they've come and another on the other perimeter, that makes more sense. So that actually makes the sense that the first arrangement for watch didn't to me. So when Gygax writes like that, it just makes me wonder, what is he thinking? You know, he's very knowledgeable about all this stuff. You know, he's more than just a history buff. He's a buff about, you know, the history of warfare from, you know, like strategic to tactical. And so when he does these things that don't make tactical sense to me, it really makes me wonder, what is he doing? What is he thinking? And usually he is thinking something. I just wish he'd, you know, I'm very interested to hear his thought process on this. All right, I am going to restart. And then they mentioned that their goal is going to be coming off through and into the Kingdom of Selene. So I'm very intrigued when they cross over to that area. All right, I am going to restart. It is page 78 in paragraph 2. Whatever they were doing, it seemed to be working. Going through the forest on a northwesterly axis, the party managed to reach the banks of the Jewel River 8 days after entering the gloom of the Sus. They encountered remarkably few hostile creatures on the trip, and all agreed that this was probably due to their own remarkable state of alertness and preparation. Creatures avoided them, for their group certainly constituted a formidable threat to anything they were likely to come across, dragons and swarms of humanoids notwithstanding. An unwary hunter was soon devoured by other carnivores, and this party was never unwary. Yeah, and it's commented that if you've dug holes in the forest, you do find that root system. And mine's more in general that I worked as a landscaper, and it was just when you had to dig. You know, it's never like landscaping shows where the crew comes in, deals with all the ground, and leaves this very pre-dug soil for the people on the show to just shovel, put a shovel in and lift it up as if it's nothing. So I find what's interesting here. Now we have another, we're given a rate of travel, which was about 6 miles a day, and then eight days. They have reached the Jewel River, and like was asked earlier, they're on about their direction. They're on a northwesterly axis, so we have a good idea from Badwall what direction they're moving. All right, and then I just wonder if the mention of dragons is serious or just used to show how, you know, dangerous the area can be, and that even this group, would not be, easily able to take on a dragon. But the mention of dragons makes me wonder, are there dragons actually in the Sus Forest? One of the things I've found always interesting about Greyhawk the Greyhawk campaign is the relatively few dragons that you run into. It's, you know, in most of the, like the modules and the such, there really is not like a terrific amount of dragons. And honestly, I've always liked that about the campaign, that we are not inundated with dragons. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 78, paragraph 3. On the east bank of the Jewel, Curly Greenleaf finally broke out his secret information. It was a reproduction of an ancient map that crudely depicted the area they were in at a long time past. This drawing showed that there was a city just a few miles, as far as they could determine anyway, north of their present location. 2 days of trekking up the Jewel discovered nothing. However, there was no thought of turning back, for the map couldn't be that inaccurate, and the force pursuing would be coming from that direction anyway. They sat down that night for a council once again. Gord had been thrown into Deirdre's proximity many times during the past week, and now he could at least tolerate her without difficulty. She showed no personal antagonism either, brushing aside his preferred apology with a comment about males having to prove their superiority, while females always demonstrated the masculine effort to be fruitless. Because she obviously believed this, Gord actually reacted in a manner that tended to reinforce Deirdre's assertion. But when he realized the trap he was in, Gord quickly ceased his efforts to do anything other than excel at his own profession and otherwise keep his own counsel. Thus they now interrelated well enough to exchange ideas freely and to contribute to the overall aims of the group. Everyone studied the old map, no doubt crudely drawn originally. It nonetheless had been copied with exacting care. From what they could determine, they had to be within a few miles of their goal. Only the ruin of the ancient city did not seem to exist. Many things were possible. The entire cities did not just disappear. Could it have been razed? If torn down stone by stone, a place such as the map depicted could be made to vanish. But there was no legend or tale that even hinted at this happening, and nothing of the sort in history, of course. Perhaps the whole thing was a fable. Perhaps, but with so much evidence at hand, albeit information of cryptic sort, that seemed doubtful. In college, Gord said idly, we spent some time in the study of natural history. Over ages, even the greatest of rivers change their courses, do they not? You've hit on it, Deirdre shouted, slamming Gord on the back, so hard he nearly choked. Without even knowing it, she announced to the others, this city-bred commoner has solved a riddle even I couldn't. No offense, Gord, or the rest of you, for that matter. It's just that we of nobler birth are expected to bear a greater burden in such matters. Well, I say now's no time for chit-chat, but for action. Just so, Geller agreed, casting an understanding smile at Gord, and then a broad grin at the rest. Our good cavalier here may not be diplomatic, but she is eager and willing. Let us press on now. From a vantage point on the riverbank, we can determine what needs to be investigated. Leaving the clearing, the 13 adventurers cut through the heavy underbrush, down a steep bluff of some 20 or 30 feet, and were soon on the relatively open bank of the river. The wizard cast one of his spells, levitating upward 100 yards, then 200, surveying the whole of the surrounding territory. Oscar dropped downward like a stone then, evidently wary of possible attack by flying monsters. When in such an exposed position, Gord was interested, in the technique. For the wizard suddenly slowed his descent, floating much as a leaf in a gentle breeze for the final 50 feet of the descent. Ring of feather falling, Deirdre told him before he could ask anyone. "There is a marshy place across the river to the south," Oscar told the awaiting company. "I could see streams and at least two large ponds there also. My supposition is that the Jewel once flowed through that area and has moved eastward since." "Was there anything like ruins, buildings, walls, anything?" demanded Greenleaf. The wizard considered for a moment. "No, there were no visible signs of any construction, but something did seem unusual." "Out with it, man," cried Geller. "The western side of the river is lower than this side, you know. I saw a few hills and ridges, but that wasn't what interested me. Half a league downstream, about at the midpoint of the marsh there, is a small peninsula, more a point of land, actually. It is wooded, indicating it is higher than the surrounding marsh-covered ground, and had several knolls and mounds on it. I fear it isn't much of a hope, but that's all I can give us to go on. The ancient city could, after all, have been washed away or covered by the Jewel when some cataclysm changed its course." The river where they stood was a long bow shot across, no more. If there were narrower places, they weren't nearby, so it was decided to cross to the west bank immediately and work southward from there. That way, no risk of encountering oncoming pursuers was likely, although Oscar pointed out it would mean going through 200 or 300 yards of swampy ground. Getting across with the horses was dangerous, for the river was both deep and swift. Furthermore, who knew what creatures lurked below the surface? Anything from giant garfish or pike to monstrous snapping turtles might be lying in wait for a meal. All right, break. Chris has posted here a little about the Ring of Feather falling. And obviously, I guess it's probably the other spells just levitate. We have a little description of what's most likely going to be the lost city of the Sul. So, of the Sulis and the Sus Forest. So, if you're using this description, for your campaign, then you know one thing. Gygax has an old map existing, and then on the other he has where it may be located in a marshy area instead of east of the Jewel. It is now west of the Jewel, and that there's some mounds and knolls, the rises in the land where there are some woods in the marshy area to show that the ground is firm. Now, Chris has posted this little list of rings, and the Feather Falling Ring from the DMG is 5,000 gold pieces. Now, absolutely absurd in Gygax's economy. That 5,000 gold, that's more likely to be 5 gold or 10 gold. Gord purchased his long-tooth dagger. And the cost, I believe, was 6 gold for that long-tooth dagger, which I felt was pretty low. You know, I mean, we had already seen the value of magic items to a little extent and how just rare they are. Gord started to build up more of them, but they are not. There's no Monty Hallism in Gygax's campaign. So you're really lucky to come across some magic items. And he gets this relatively early on because first he has a long tooth meant for humanoids or demi-humans. Anyway, it's not meant for human use, but it's still very powerful. And then he gets this that it is meant for human use. And, gold is worth a bundle, but I think such a powerful weapon from a knowledgeable vendor would not go so cheap. So we've covered a little bit of ground here. There were a few things that were mentioned that were interesting. We have a little bit more of Gord's character. We have a little bit more of Deirdre's, character being here. I think, although we learn that Deirdre is a member of the nobility, And she is, you know, she is a knight. She is a cavalier. And, you know, she is going to have an ethos, I would expect, going with her. She was a cleric. She's become a cavalier. So she really sounds like she is going, she's going to have, like, a much more structured and formal background and an attitude that goes with that. And
she seems to have this, a similar attitude to the cavalier in the cartoon.
Ah, okay. I'm not familiar with the cartoon, but yeah.
He was a little haughty.
Yeah, and she is. Not very, but a little. So far, I haven't thought of her as too haughty or anything.
No.
Alright, and alright, so one of the things we know that mapping existed. But this was supposed to be a Los Sulis city, and I wonder if it's supposed to be pre-cataclysm, which is, you know, long in the past. And again, there's a little, no information about anything, you know, too dire about the city, about it being razed, as I believe Curly or Geller puts it, that it would have been taken apart and knocked down stone by stone. Genghis Khan is said to have, or at least the descendants of Genghis Khan, came to the city of Samarkand, which was supposed to be a monstrously big, like a million population city, on the trade route from east to west. And when they rebelled, he came back and he devastated the city, and then had the survivors dig up the stones, the foundation stones, and cart them away, so that when travelers came back the next season for the, you know, the trade, they found an empty piece of ground where this city of almost a million had been. And that's, you know, maybe true or not true. It's just one of the things I believe I read in Lamb's biography of Genghis Khan. So anyway, you know, this lost city is supposed to, you know, be gone, but not utterly destroyed. So yeah, Chris puts up a little thing about what that killing emissaries was a violation. After they killed Genghis Khan's envoys, it was, you know, a decidedly poor, yeah, that poor act.
A decision on his part.
Yeah, and they're pointing out that Deirdre has, you know, her own a chauvinistic idea that, you know, she's feeling that men aren't as good as women, but definitely that does come back from, you know, it's part of her character and maybe an indication of Hardby. You know, which is, you know, ruled by the Ginarchy. And obviously,
there's a lot of there's a lot of parallels to the Amazons in Hardby.
Yes. And, you know, I can't think, they have common, I think there was common about, like, you know, warriors like that, but there isn't, I don't think there's a direct, you know, quote of on having an Amazonian style culture, you know, anywhere, you know, on in the descriptions from at least the folio and 83 box set. I don't think can mention anything like that. I'm not as familiar yet, even though I've read it all, I'm not as familiar yet with the various restarts, like, you know, From the Ashes and The Adventure Begins and Player's Guide and even the LGG. I'm not quite as familiar to know if there is a culture that's brought in like that. But other than Hardby, it's the only one offhand that I know of. Now, the Rene culture, they're very cavalier with their young women, but the older women are supposed to actually be you know, the leaders of the at least the barge folk. They're soothsayers and witches and like this combination of such. All right.
Yeah, certainly.
So, yes. And they are, in general, Renee, are a little more casual about the loss of life, men and women, when they're younger. Now, from the point where Oscar rose up into the sky, probably on a levitate, he does talk about it only being 200 or 300 yards of swampy ground around that area from where he rose. He mentioned several kind of monsters that might be in the Jewel River. And I don't know if, again, I don't know how accurate that might be. There was some comment that I read yesterday about the use of a third-person omniscient viewpoint, and I'm not quite sure it's as prevalent as maybe the opinion was, because for the most part, I notice it comes from every direction that you get this unreliable narrative, because it's simply the opinion of various characters, not just Gord, not just Geller, but even people like you just encounter. I believe there was a comment by the innkeeper at Badwall of the brass ball that was, again, something from his viewpoint. That, and so you can't really believe everything that is being said, because it is there's very little here that I think is absolutely trustworthy. And I mean that Gygax doesn't design this to be absolutely trustworthy in the various opinions. I think he likes everything to be looked at from someone's biased viewpoint. And by bias, I just mean everybody is a subject. They're all personal, and they all have, their own senses and their own background and upkeeping and how they were raised and such. And it does point a slant on every individual on how they see things. And like using something modern, if you look at the show Big Bang Theory, then you get how, like, the Sheldon character views things so out of joint with what most other people he's there with view things. And that is that there's always, you know, an individual viewpoint and sometimes radically different viewpoints, for one reason or another, of people seeing the same thing. So we're getting, we're seeing that there are possible garfish, pike, or snapping turtles in the Jewel River within the Sus. All right. Now, I am going to restart. It's page 80. And the final paragraph. Although they disliked doing it, Curly Greenleaf and his associates, Ash, Grover, and Lorman, located a small herd of deer and, after much effort, managed to drive them into the water near where the party planned to cross. Those creatures swam across the river, the current carrying them downstream so that their course toward the opposite shore was a diagonal one. Just as the deer were past the midpoint of the channel, and as the group was already beginning to swim in the wake of the herd, something struck. There was a great swirl in the water, and one of the deer simply vanished. One second, its head was visible. The next, only ripples showed where it had been. From their prone positions, none of the adventurers could see what took the animal, but whatever it was had been huge. Although everyone was very nervous, and Oscar went immediately into the air to provide some protection from that vantage point, nothing further occurred. By using the horses and swimming strongly, they were all soon safely across and concealed in the trees. The wizard ceased his magical flight and joined them, and after a bit of ringing out, they began eagerly moving southward toward what they hoped was the goal of their quest. All right, break. That's breaking right here. Yes. We get the red shirts' names now. Ash, Grover, and Lorman are the name of the three druids.
They're people.
And You know, it really was striking to me that they were just Gore didn't ever learn their names back in Bad Wall, and they were just the three druids. And I thought, my, that is very bad idea there. Those poor guys, you know, unnamed druid 1, 2, and 3 don't seem likely to survive. So yeah, now they're named. And then we do get a good idea. Now, boy, the Jewel is a very deep river then, you know, very deep at this point, very, very cut. And the city itself, you know, may have been, inside like one of the ravines they talked about, or at least in a lower, you know, lower area. It, for such a place near a waterway, you know, but we get that also in the city of Greyhawk, where the Selatan and the Greyflow are surrounding the city. And, you know, there are rises in lower areas within the city. Lukesh has most of the city on a hill, maybe because the shoreline floods. But yeah, you know, it is, again, one of the things I really like about Gygax's designs is that he did not think that this was all flat terrain, that cities weren't, forests weren't, that you're going to go up and down, and, you know, that they're going to have all kinds of terrain there. And he is trying to think about what effects there are of, you know, what the rivers are or such. And I know there's a lot of work to be done in Greyhawk to make sense and of the waterways. And I know Anna Meyer has done an immense amount of work making sense of the various waterways that run through the Flinnesse. All right. So that idea of using the deer, that is a very good one. It's a very good idea that if you are a player, that you think of things. I know one group of players would take a cow and have it walk down the dungeon corridor to set off traps, you know, hard on the cow, but, you know, big and heavy enough to set off anything they were likely to set off themselves. All right. I am going to restart. We're on page 81, and it is the fourth paragraph. After somewhat over a mile of forcing their way through the tangled forest, they noticed that the trees were smaller and there were tamaracks and similar water-loving kinds ahead. Then the ground underfoot became spongy and wet, quickly turning into tussocked bits of earth separated by shallow water. Before long, they were fighting against the drag of the mud, dirty and dripping with ooze, carefully choosing their path so as to avoid mires and deep pools. There were large insects, huge spiders, and great goggle-eyed frogs here aplenty. Batrachians evidently fed on the insects and arachnids, keeping them in relatively low numbers, and there were monstrous cranes and other gigantic wading birds that must have found the fish and frogs of the marsh most beneficial. Other than sinking forever in the muck, though, there was nothing hazardous here, at least during their passage, and the 13 bedraggled adventurers finally reached the piece of high, firm ground that formed a small peninsula jutting into the Jewel River. All right, break. Yes, and one of the things, again, one of the things I really love about these books are little descriptions like this. Now, for the most part, all the things he's describing, insects, huge spiders, goggle-eyed frogs, the cranes, you know, that is just, you know, instead of just saying, well, you cross the marsh, and there was no attacks, you know, instead of bare bones description, here a DM should think about, you know, adding life to it and making them think about things like, you know, like you could have them being plagued by biting insects. They could be disturbed by the sound of frogs, which can have surprisingly make surprising loud and booming noises. you know, there's all different kinds of things that aren't necessarily just straight combat encounters that you can really add to this to spice up a normal bit of wilderness crossing into something a little more. Now, you don't have to do it all the time. Now, it's commented here, odd to see Tamarok in this environment. But yeah, the description is evocative. Anyone have, I offhand don't remember what a Tamarok is. I've heard them before, but I don't know what it is.
I posted it. It's Larix larcinia or something, known as the Tamarack Hatch Metac, Eastern Larch, Black Larch, Red Larch, or American Larch. It's a some tree, but it looks like it's from Canada.
The larch. Yeah, okay. All right. Yeah, I didn't know if it was flora or fauna there. So yeah, that's that's.
It says it goes to West Virginia, though.
Oh, all right. Yeah, and believe me, West Virginia can be hot. Okay. All right.
He's really got a great author's vocabulary.
He does, and think about how interesting everything is, and you know, talking about now, there's nothing sucking them down, but there's the danger of a mire. And, you know, instead of walking just, oh, where you make your way through the swamp and blah, here they're fighting their way through the swamp, and it's slowing them and making them filthy and, you know, pulling at them. Wonderful. You know, just absolutely wonderful to add to your campaign. So one of the things about the Gord books is they are filled with material like this that you can just simply cut right out, and you know, have a little box text waiting to describe anything from going through a swamp or a forest or a hilly area, or sitting down like they were in Stoink and eating a meal at a fairly fancy inn. You know, there's such wonderful descriptions here in these books that really, you know, and perfect, you know, absolutely perfect for a Greyhawk campaign.
He paints a very full picture. It's good.
Does. And, you know, that's one of the reasons I absolutely love going through these books. So I'm going to restart here. It is page 81, second paragraph from the end. "Gods, you look a filthy mess," Deirdre said to Gord. A young thief had stumbled and fallen partway into the marsh, and then had covered himself with mud in the process of extricating himself. The female knight looked relatively clean and proper despite the trek, although her armor was sullied and her hair somewhat limp with sweat. Gord tried to clean his hands on his leggings, but got them only dirtier still, for the leather garments were caked with smelly black muck. He looked at his hands and couldn't resist. "And you look wonderful, Lady Chevalier." He examined to Deirdre, and then patted her on both cheeks with his muddy palms and fingers. Deirdre tried to avoid the touch, but Gord was much too quick. "You nasty little bastard," she shouted at him, taking a step backward and trying to draw forth her broadsword at the same time. Her foot struck something, though, so Deirdre overbalanced backward and sat down hard. "Oh, my dear," Gord said in mock sympathy, "you must be too exhausted to stand. Or is it simply that a woman as large and clumsy as you are can't manage a backward step without falling like an ox?" "Why, you," Deirdre managed, her face flushed. Then Oscar was beside her, pressing her shoulders down so she could stand and strike the jabbing thief with her sword in her sudden. So she couldn't stand and strike the japing thief with her sword in her sudden ire. "Relax, love," the wizard said soothingly. "We are all tired and in need a bit of a breather. Don't let something foolish," and here he gazed meaningfully toward Gord, "betray your sworn oath to serve in this endeavor." Deirdre made a face at him, but she relaxed. "You do look rather silly now, dearie," said to the girl. "Almost as sorry as Gord there, and he's a muckworm if I've ever laid eyes on one." Everyone laughed then, and the tension was dispelled, Deirdre actually grinned at Gord, sharing his discomfort of being tired and dirty, and recognizing him as part of her team, as it were. She tried to get a bit more comfortable on her seat. Then she suddenly jumped up and tore at the viny growth that had been under her. "What's wrong?" Gord exclaimed, rushing over to see if perhaps something had bitten her. "This is a stone block," Deirdre shouted. "I've been sitting on our lost ruin for 5 minutes without knowing it." A break.
I've read this before, so I'm not sure if I immediately recognized that she sat down on something solid rather than, I assumed that she was going to fall back into the mire and get herself muddy, but she lands on something solid. This is a little bit of Gygax's attempt at humor. I don't find it, you know, it's a very, as somebody who's written I find it very hard to miss most of the time that very very hard to decide it. I found, you know, little bit of this, just, you know, it's part of the storyline. Then the big thing is that here that they've obviously discovered some bit of stone, and looks like worked stone. So I'd say Deirdre's probably right here, and they've discovered the lost city of the Sulis here in the Sus Forest.
I find myself forgetting much more of this book than Saga of Old City. I don't think I've had a single epiphany yet where, like, I was like, oh, wow, I remember that.
The only thing is coming up, I did remember, I remember the monk fight, all right? That stuck with me. And I remember stuff about the siege, but only little bits and pieces. And here, I've remembered, I think I've got some memory of what's going to happen, but I'm not entirely sure. But, you know, it hasn't happened yet. All right, so I'm going to restart. It is page 83 and the first paragraph. Although the shadows were growing long, pardon me 1 second. I've got to shut my front door. So my neighbor's working on something with a power saw. Sorry about that. All right. Starting here at the first paragraph of page 83. Although the shadows were growing long, the whole group was so excited about the find that everyone wanted nothing more than to begin an immediate search for the great ziggurat at the center of the ancient metropolis. The area was so overgrown with ground cover, bushes, shrubs, and all sorts of trees that the party could not actually hope to do more than a cursory search before darkness. All right, so here's something for Gary, who was very interested in anything about the city. So there is a great ziggurat at its center. They're still looking for it. So obviously, it sounds like it maybe has collapsed, because Oscar was unable to see any visible signs of construction when he went up in the air. But that's a nice little bit to add to the lore of, of the lost city of the Sul. All right, it's page 83, paragraph 2. I'm restarting. After an hour or so, Blanc came across a collapsed structure that was still accessible.
A portion of the lower story made an acceptable shelter, the walls and roof overhead being relatively sound. The place would serve as shelter against the weather and the night prowlers. It was sufficiently large to allow the party to stable their horses as well. So before long, all were securely housed, with the entry partially blocked by chunks of masonry, magical guards in place, and a small fire going at the rear of the place. "This is not soul workmanship," Geller remarked as he studied the bas-relief carvings on the walls revealed by the ruddy firelight. "Come here, Curly, and take a look. This convoluted script is like none I've ever seen." Although time had worn the stone somewhat, the writing and carving were still clearly definable, sheltered as the stone was within the ruin. The druid agreed that it was totally unfamiliar. Ford took a look, as did Blanc, followed by Oscar. None recognized it as anything they had previously seen. No wonder that the Scarlet Brotherhood had no intelligence regarding this ruin. Legend had said the city, a city of the Sulalese, had been here, but this place was certainly of origination, predating the migration of the Invoked Devastation by centuries. A connoisseur was called over to examine it, but he was as puzzled as the rest. It bore no resemblance to any flan work he had seen, and he had seen some of the sacred writings and idols in Ten. This was a riddle not to be solved quickly, and certainly of no importance compared to their quest. Still, the two factors could somehow be linked, and Gord went to sleep considering such a possibility. Fearful of dreams such as those that had plagued him when he had been near another ruin, one imprisoning a demon. Deirdre had the watch just prior to Gord's turn. When she woke him, he felt terribly listless and vaguely recalled uneasy scenes from his sleep. He whispered that he was awake and ready to stand guard, but the tough cavalier was in no rush to return to her bed. "I'll keep you company, Gord, if you object not. I am too wide awake now to slumber," she added by way of explanation. Gord was surprised but readily agreed, for he felt uneasy. "If you prefer the chill near the entry to a warm blanket, I have no objections to your company. I like this place not at all." "It bothers you too, then." They moved to positions near the entrance, and Gord related his adventures with the druid and Chert, involving a confrontation with a catabaline demon. He told Deirdre of the malign foreboding and awful nightmares that accompanied proximity to the ancient ringstones and the crypt beneath the central cairn. While this place was dissimilar, Gord asserted he also felt a bad premonition here, different but strong nonetheless. For once, Deirdre didn't scoff. "I understand your read, Gord. This is a place better left undiscovered," she whispered. "As soon as we gain our prize, I wish nothing more than to leave it as far behind as possible, and never will I speak of it to another." "I," Gord said in agreement, "but think on this. The relic, which is the counterbalance to the greatest evil, was warded by a demon. What fell things are set round that which serves Tharizdun?" "Speak not that name," Deirdre hissed. Her look showed fear, and her voice shook as she spoke. "Locked in knighted prison or not, I think he can somehow still know and respond when his name is spoken. Remember, the savants say that the powers of evil still draw from the dream force of that terrible one." Her vehemence startled Gord, but the young thief readily understood her point and agreed. In the past, he was not much given to theological considerations of any sort, but this was different. Gord had learned many new things over the past year or two, and now his horizons had expanded further. Deirdre's warning could not be ignored. "Yes," he said earnestly, "you're right to rebuke me. I shall not be so careless in the future. Tell me, where do you think we should begin our explorations this morning? They spoke in whispers for the remainder of Gord's watch, and the golden light of the sun soon came to call the whole party to its task. Breaking here at page 85, it's the end of chapter 7, a very handy point to close for the night. It's 7 o'clock. There's a few things worth commenting on before we go. It does show the improvement of Gord's relationship with Deirdre. It shows that there is fear even in Tharizdun's name. Gord's mentioned that he wasn't very theologically bent. That may also be an indication, as Gord's from, you know, like the city of Greyhawk, that at least Greyhawkers themselves are not very closely bound to the deities, and that they may have exposure to so many varied ones that it doesn't quite lead to, say, like the worship of Farlangen that they encountered up in Nyrond. And it could be a hint. Now, the biggest thing, of course, is the strange writing and bas-reliefs on the walls that are not Flan or Sul. So it brings into question, is this the lost city of the Sul, or was there ever a lost city of the Sul, and this might be something much, much older? And perhaps linked to Tharizdun, could this be Ulmen writing? You know, it's very interesting what might be occurring right here. All right, we are now past 7, and I'm afraid it is time to call in the Craigbot and ask him to leave.
Good night.
Good night.